From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, and it's my privilege to sit in for Tony Perkins today. Well, we have a crowded show on deck, as we always do, approaching the end of a week in Washington. The House of Representatives yesterday passed a measure to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. But instead of preventing violence against women, the contents of this bill would actually permit more. Over 150 Republican members voted against the measure, indicating it might just be a giant partisan scam. Representative Debbie Lesko of Arizona's 8th Congressional District joins me today to discuss the bill and the op-ed she wrote about why she would vote against it. In my second segment, there is yet another scam afoot with the vaunted SPLC. A new report is out by the Federation for American Immigration Reform exposing the SPLC's unethical tactics used to scam journalists. At the bottom of the hour, Democrats held a hearing on Tuesday for the Equality Act, a radical bill that would introduce sweeping changes throughout all of America's federal civil rights law to give sexual orientation and gender identity the same special protections as innate, unchanging characteristics like race. FRC's Peter Sprigg is recently back from the World Congress of Families in Verona, Italy, and has a new paper out debunking the myth that sexual orientation is unchanging. He'll join me in studio to talk about it. And at 42 past the hour, social media scholar James Herson will join me to analyze an unfolding drama in Atlanta, Georgia. A Hollywood actress has taken up a metaphorical pitchfork in an attempt to intimidate the governor out of signing a bill that would protect unborn babies with a detectable heartbeat. As a reminder, you can follow our podcast online at tonyperkins.com for more information on the guests and resources we'll reference today. Be sure to follow Tony Perkins on Twitter at tperkins, and you may follow me as well at Sarah P. Perry. So we're excited to kick off this edition of the Friday Washington Watch broadcast with an individual that I'm happy to say we worked on the action side in pushing an endorsement for, Representative Debbie Lesko, the 8th Congressional District representative for the state of Arizona, wrote a recent piece in the Daily Signal about how, even though she was a survivor of domestic abuse, she would be voting against the Violence Against Women Act. Congresswoman Lesko, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So I have so many questions and so many reasons to truly love this op-ed, and the title was an extremely compelling one. The title in the Daily Signal was, "I Survived Domestic Violence. Here's Why I'm Voting No on the Violence Against Women Act." Now, as a survivor of domestic violence, did you find that this was a scary topic to broach in mainstream media?
Well, you know, certainly I'm going to have people that say that I have discriminated against all kinds of people, but nothing could be further from the truth. My goal is to protect women. I was abused by my ex-husband. Luckily, I'm one of the few, thanks to God, that got out of it. Others are still involved in abusive relationships, or very unfortunately, some have been killed. So this is a very important issue to me. Not only am I a survivor of domestic violence, but I serve on the advisory council of a domestic violence shelter in my district, and I co-chair the working group against domestic violence in Congress. And so I really, really wanted to work on a bipartisan piece of legislation that would protect women. Unfortunately, this Democrat version is not it. In fact, I think it will imperil women more.
Now, I find the title, of course, compelling because I believe the listeners, as I did originally when the bill came to light, the Violence Against Women Act has the sound of something that would very obviously have bipartisan support. But you talk about in your op-ed, and we've come to learn that there were really some very partisan provisions shoehorned into the actual text of the bill. Can you talk about some of your concerns with the bill?
Sure. There's three major reasons that I'm voting against this version of the Violence Against Women Act. The first one is that It forces domestic violence shelters under penalty of federal law to take in transgender women who are biological males with male body parts and force them to be in the same shelters as women. And some of these shelters can be set up so that they're separate living facilities, but some of them are not. So there's a real chance that you would have men sleeping next to women or men in a group shower setting with women. Now, certainly for women that have been abused, some have been sexually abused, to place a male next to them would not only invade their privacy, but could potentially, create a safety problem.
So go ahead.
I have two other reasons as well. The second is that this bill also would require prisons, again, under penalty of federal law, prisons to take in biological males who identify as women and put them in women prisons. And the United Kingdom, they did this with a man who identified as a woman. Well, he raped two women. So again, this is a potential safety problem. Now, this won't be the case with every transgender, of course, but there are some people that have ill intent. The third problem I have is that it takes away gun rights of people without their due process in court. So I really believe that the Democrats, whether some of the women that are supporting this know or not, they intentionally put in things in this Violence Against Women Act that they knew Republicans would oppose, so that then when Republicans voted against it, they could say, see, Republicans are against women that are abused, which could be nothing further from the truth.
That's extremely astute on your part to be able to recognize that, because truly the House has presented such a stumbling block as far as, among other things, gender identity is concerned. And indeed, we saw earlier this week hearings on the oft-discussed Equality Act, which Nancy Pelosi has made a bit of her cause celeb in this congressional session. And we find these discussions about gender identity finding their way in toward the perimeter of bills that would otherwise have bipartisan support, as this particular Violence Against Women Act. You talked about this case of a prison in the United Kingdom where a man who identified as a woman raped two women in prison. We understand these statistics are not representative, obviously, of the entirety of the population and that these are one-offs, for example. But your particular concern seems to be geared more toward the majority than the minority. In other words, the women that are sharing same-sex spaces are in the majority in terms of their numbers. These are all biological women. What we are adding is the addition of a biological male. Do you have concerns outside of just the prison context and just the domestic abuse shelter as well? Is this notion of gender equality, are you seeing movement on this and other bills in the House?
Yeah, well, certainly nobody wants to discriminate against transgenders, and there's nothing stopping domestic violence shelters or any other shelters from taking in whoever they want. But what these bills do, when they're giving a protected status to transgender women who are biological males, many with still have male body parts, and forcing them, if they take any money from the federal government, this law will force them to take in biological males and put them with women. Well, this, you know, I sit on the Judiciary Committee, so we had testimony on the Equality Act, and I will be there for the bill hearing on the Equality Act. And certainly this is a major concern, because now we're going to get into women's sports, girls' sports, letting men into sports. I mean, this has already come up, I believe, in Connecticut, where a woman lost her scholarship because they were biological men identifying themselves as women in the women's sports team. And, you know, this is just I think I don't understand it. For instance, I was in the Rules Committee, and I said biological males that identify as women are going into women shelters. And the chairman of the committee said, they are not biological males. They are transgender women. And I said, well, if they have male body parts, they're biological males. Right. And I just find it incredible that people are denying that they're males. I mean, I think they want to get rid of the word woman and man and just have everybody be the same sex, which is just not dealing in reality.
I would agree. In fact, it is so refreshing to hear such obvious, clear-eyed logic from someone on Capitol Hill. I think those of us who work and live around the Washington, D.C. area have a tendency to become slightly jaded. And we understand that you can make word salad out of just about anything on Capitol Hill. But in reality, I think you and I would agree that the notion of the biological reality, the chromosomal differentiation between men and women that has been settled fact for thousands of years, would ever enter the public debate sphere. And the fact that you can have individuals with all male parts sharing same sex areas with women, to me, is absolutely mind-boggling. So it's refreshing for us to hear such good, rational, obvious identification of what for the rest of Washington, D.C. seems to have become a bit of a pet project.
Well, you know, this isn't like a topic that I came to Washington, D.C. to talk about, quite frankly, but the more I researched this, the more concerned I was. And I thought somebody needs to speak out the obvious on this and get some common sense rationale into our laws. I mean, no one wants to discriminate against anyone. I certainly don't. But having the government force shelters, force school sports, force, you know, prisons to put men in with women, I mean, we need some common sense approaches. And you know, I hope that people are listening and will repeat what I say, because what's happening is too many people, not only on Capitol Hill, but everywhere, are afraid to talk about this issue. It's a difficult issue to talk about. No one wants to be discriminated against. I've been told that I'm discriminating against transgenders. Nothing could be further from the truth, but we have to protect the women and the girls. You know,
Amen.
This is so important. And the more, you know, this is becoming too popular of a movement where I'm concerned about young teenage girls who are getting hormone therapy and those type of things. This needs to be rationally dealt with.
Congresswoman Debbie Lesko from Arizona's 8th Congressional District has been my guest. Congresswoman, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. It's headed to the Senate next. We'll be watching for it. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, in for Tony Perkins. Up next, a new report from the Federation for American Immigration Reform on the SPLC. We'll be right back.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
Happy birthday to you.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday to you.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today on this Friday edition. Well, just this week, the Federation for American Immigration Reform released a new report titled A Journalist's Guide to Understanding the Tactics of the SPLC. The SPLC has had quite a bit of attention attracted by the media here recently with the exposure of the misdeeds of Mr. Morris Deese and the high-profile resignation of four individuals in top leadership at the SPLC. Joining me today to discuss this journalist's guide is longtime journalist himself, Ira Melman, who serves as the media director for the Federation of American Immigration Reform. Ira, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks very much.
So, Ira, you and I share a particularly offensive title, and that is our affiliation with a hate group. So we both have a particular interest in the comings and goings of the SPLC and their misdeeds. What was it in particular that prompted FAIR to issue what is truly a groundbreaking report dedicated toward the journalistic industry itself?
Well, you know, the SPLC has thrived, and they have gotten a lot of attention because they have enablers in the media. You have reporters who aren't doing their job, which is to investigate claims made by groups like the SPLC to determine whether they have any veracity. They simply report that the SPLC labeled this group a hate group or, you know, whatever it is they are charging them with. Because it suits their needs, it gets across their position without exposing them to any kind of retribution for slander. And so, you know, they have been allowing the SPLC to get away with this for a long time. And they shouldn't, because quite frankly, many of their colleagues who have actually looked at the activities of the SPLC have concluded that it is a totally discredited organization. And it's not just journalists on the right. It is across the spectrum. The late Alexander Cockburn, who wrote for The Nation and for all sorts of far-left publications, repeatedly went after them for their tactics and for their fundraising, just, you know, the going after all kinds of money based on these assertions. So, you know, they've had a lot of help from the media. And you know, I'm sorry, the media have ignored basically a lot of work that has been done by their own colleagues that has discredited the SPLC, and they continue to do it to this day.
You and I understand full well that there are consequences to these kinds of hate classifications, and that playing fast and loose with labels like hate, because they are sort of fungible enough not to be subject to every particular defamation law. And the SPLC, populated by 350 attorneys, knows full well that they have to sort of protect their flank when it comes to their legal definitions. But indeed, they had to pay Majid Nawaz $3.34 million last summer for calling him, though he is Muslim himself, an anti-Muslim extremist. Here in our offices in Washington, D.C., an armed gunman opened fire on our unmanned building manager in 2012. Steve Scalise, often pilloried by the SPLC, was shot at a baseball field after an individual followed and liked the SPLC and its publications on social media. So there is a real-world connection to the labeling and the mapping that the SPLC has risen to prominence with. And in fact, it represents a sort of lazy reporting. And as a journalist, you understand this. To cite a source without determining independently its veracity is really sort of its own level of journalistic malfeasance, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And that's why, you know, I call them the enablers for the SPLC. And that's why this is directed at journalists, because without the media giving them this megaphone, their reports would have no coverage whatever. You know, they could call people whatever names they want. The reason that it's become so profitable, the reason they've been able to amass more than $500 million in assets, is because the media is out there saying, well, you know, the SPLC called these folks a hate group, and, you know, then they go out and fundraise, so it becomes just this vicious circle here where the media gets cover by saying, well, you know, we're just quoting the SPLC. The SPLC gets the publicity, and they get to rake in a lot of money that they're not using for the programs they claim to be using them for.
It's very much a hand and glove fit. And you mentioned something that I don't think all of our listeners are full aware of, and that is the fact that there have been cited reports and op-eds and articles really from all across the political spectrum. And it is sort of that facile use of the label by mainstream media outlets and the majority of the big tech firms that seems to ignore the fact that Harper's and Politico and The Social Contract and The New York Times and even CNN to a certain respect and Washington Post, David Montgomery's piece, the first time The Washington Post has ever called into account whether or not the SPLC may have been tagging unnecessarily and inappropriately with that hate group label. So it's so important, I think, for our listeners to recognize that the paper does such an excellent job of providing this compendium of resources, sort of an overview of someone from the industry for the industry, of saying, you all really need to do your homework, because why an organization with $500 million gets to continue to amass funding on really nothing more than continuing to fundraise and defame people, I think is beyond the pale for all of us.
It is. Look, I mean, the reporters are doing this because, as I said, they want to have the cover. They want to express an opinion, but sort of, you know, say it's the SPLC's opinion. But, you know, maybe we should have called this the lazy journalist's guide to the SPLC, because this publication includes hyperlinks to these dozens and dozens of articles that you mentioned, appearing in publications as diverse as The Washington Post, Politico, Harper's, The Nation. You know, you don't get any farther left than The Nation. They've excoriated the SPLC. So, you know, if you're too lazy to go out there and do a Google search on your own, you can just go to this publication, click on the hyperlink, and you can have all the information right there at your fingertips.
Ira Melman has been my guest from the Federation for American Immigration Reform. His excellent report is out on the FAIR website now. I encourage you to investigate for yourselves. You are listening to Washington Watch, and I'm Sarah Perry in for Tony Perkins this Friday. Coming up next, our own Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, Peter Sprague, back from Verona and ready to talk about changing sexual orientation. We'll be right back.
Grandpa Jerry, what are you doing?
What? What does it look like I'm doing? I'm sitting on this bench enjoying my tea and reading the news.
You always tell me that I need to stand firm for faith, family, and freedom. Why aren't you standing?
Well, now with this new Stand Firm app, I can sit and stand at the same time. And if you got the Stand Firm app, you could learn something besides that garbage of peddling in public schools. You could listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, where Tony and leaders on the Hill and other culture influences weigh in on current events. You can read FRC's latest publications and articles responding to what's going on in the news, like this.
Oh.
You can play trivia and earn points for free prizes. You can even access all of FRC's publications directly to sharpen your mind and give you the ability to discern the thoughts and intentions of the heart.
I can be a mind reader?
Kid, that's from the Bible, the richest piece of literature on God's green earth.
Can I see this stand up? Wow, this would keep me informed. Visit frc.org/app to download FRC's Stand Firm app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, and I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, our own Senior Fellow for Policy Studies is the gentleman back from Verona, Peter Sprigg, and he is back from the World Congress of Families, where he was delivering a new publication on sexual orientation and how it can indeed change. So he's going to talk a little bit about his paper and about some of the other impressions he had from the 13th annual World Congress of Families in Verona, Italy. Peter, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thanks, Sarah. And hopefully, since we're in the studio together, I won't get cut off this time like I did last Friday when I spoke to you from Verona.
It's wonderful to have you back. I want to hear a little bit about the World Congress of Families event itself. We who are stateside, who aren't able to attend an event like this, share with us some of the most compelling research that you heard in a particular session that stood out to you.
Well, yeah, the event was tremendous, and it was exciting. A number of the Italian speakers who defended the event against the critics and the protesters who had really wanted to shut it down and prevent it from happening at all. I was impressed with the courage of the people who stood up in defense of this event, which was very controversial. But yeah, I had wanted to mention one presentation actually by an American, named Steve Turley. I didn't know Steve Turley before this. But he's an American scholar and educator and radio host, and he gave a fascinating talk about a field of scholarship. Apparently, that there's a whole field of scholarship called post-secular studies.
Mm.
Now, this is fascinating because so often we're told, oh, we live in a secular society, we're secularizing and so forth. He said that actually secular liberals are panicked.
Mm.
And the reason, ironically, is the doom of the secularists is in their own individualism, their own devotion to radical individualism will make their movement implode, he said. And the reason is simple demographics, because secular people do not have children. Religious people are the ones who are having children.
Interesting.
And so you will have this inevitable evolution of the population in the direction of becoming a more and more religious population just because of who is having the children. And he says this is happening worldwide, that there is Christianity is growing faster than the population in Africa. China is experiencing the greatest revival in history. Pentecostalism is sweeping Latin America. Mm. He said it's the greatest religious surge the world has ever seen, and the population trends are only going to increase it. And in the United States, he kind of joked that in 200 years, America will consist entirely of evangelicals, Mormons, and Amish people because those are the ones having babies.
Now, this is very interesting to me because Dennis Prager just had a piece out, just in an op-ed in the Daily Signal just a day or two ago, in which he said, the left keeps me religious. And that whole notion of radicalized individualism and the self-segmenting, the siloing of identities per particular characteristic seems to drive so much of how the left performs this regressive liberalism. In fact, Majid Nawad, we were just referring to him in the last segment on the SPLC, actually wrote a pretty groundbreaking piece himself about this regressive liberalism. In other words, there is only so far your identity will get you, because when you choose that as your course of identification, whether it is your sexual orientation or your gender identity, as your paper discusses, you really find yourself winnowing out the ability to interact with others and indeed rely on bigger movements and bigger ideals, bigger concepts for your source of worth and identification.
Yeah, and another thing about the left is that a number of speakers brought up, it was interesting when the similar themes came up over and over again. And one thing that came up a lot was that the left likes to talk about rights, but they don't talk about obligations. Mm. That we need to have a balance of rights and obligations, of rights and duties. And this is what a healthy society consists of. It's not all about rights. It's about rights and duties.
Absolutely. So you introduced a paper that you wrote about whether or not sexual orientation, which we have heard now for decades, is an immutable characteristic, and it really is the peg on which the left has hung their sort of jurisprudential and their congressional hat. Talk to me a little bit about the research, and I want to particularly go to the research for Lisa Diamond, and I want to talk a little bit about Clifford Roski. So tell me very briefly, in the 2 minutes that we have left, what about their research as left-wingers really compelled you?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Lisa Diamond is herself a lesbian, or identifies as a lesbian at the University of Utah, and Clifford Roski is a law school colleague of hers. They've written an important article in 2016 called Scrutinizing Immutability, which basically goes through all the research and destroys the idea that sexual orientation is an immutable characteristic. Mm. She's doing this coming from a leftist perspective, but she's an expert in what she refers to as sexual fluidity. Now, so I relied on that, but I did my own original analysis of some of the studies that she cited in my new paper, a new issue analysis called The evidence that sexual orientation can change, debunking the myth of immutability. So we have, you know, I was kind of put on to this by a question that I got from a constituent and by her research. I did my own independent analysis. It all came together to make a very compelling case that, in fact, sexual orientation can change all of the elements of sexual orientation, which consists of attractions, behavior, and identity, can all change.
You've been listening to Washington Watch. For more information on Peter's paper, go to tonyperkins.com. Click the link under today's show. He has been my great guest today. Wish we had more time. Coming up next after this on the Friday edition of Washington Watch, we will talk about Hollywood and the heartbeat bill. We'll be right back.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I've been your host, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action. It is my privilege to sit in for Tony Perkins today, and we will be talking about another abortion bill at the state level this segment. But this one has the particular interest of a group of Hollywood folks. Last week, the Georgia legislature passed a bill that would ban most abortions after a detectable heartbeat was protected. And that indeed could happen as early as 6 to 8 weeks. So on Tuesday of this week, Hollywood actress Alyssa Milano and several dozen film workers in Georgia wrote the governor urging him not to sign the legislation. Will Governor Brian Kemp cave to the outside pressure of Hollywood? Here to explain the situation is James Herson, law professor at Trinity Law School and Biola University. He is the author of a book titled Hollywood Nation: Left Coast Lies, Old Media Spin, and the New Media Revolution. He regularly keeps tabs on Hollywood in his weekly column at Newsmax.com called The Left Coast Report. I love it. James, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you, Sarah. How are you?
I'm well. I have so many questions. First, about the book, and we have to go to this title, Hollywood Nation, Left Coast Lies, Old Media Spin, and New Media Revolution. How refreshing to know that you are calling from California, and you are someone who so fully understands the sometimes incestuous relationship between politics and Hollywood. What was your most surprising revelation in writing this book?
Well, I've been for many years, I work in Hollywood. I'm an entertainment lawyer, and I've represented clients, and I've dealt with both the executive class and the people who were involved in creativity. And I think the most amazing thing is the fact that Hollywood now basically is willing to give up civil liberties, individual rights, a host of things that used to be associated with the left in order to now be part of this sort of new left, which is a totalitarian concept. And just to give you an idea of how far out of touch Hollywood is with the values of America, this young actor, Jussie Smollett, thought that he could improve his career by making himself the victim of a fake hate crime. And that speaks volumes as to how strange and bizarre this other world is in the entertainment business. I mean, we see this sort of thing in urban areas around the country that have become leftist enclaves, but Hollywood is sort of an exaggeration of that. And notions of logic, consistency, critical thinking, not really there. Part of it has to do with the fact that a lot of the people that speak out on these issues in Hollywood are celebrities, that their stock in trade is emotion, and their stock in trade is crying on cue, which they're very good at, but not so good at being informed or having any kind of logical thought process.
It's interesting in that the 2016 election cycle, we heard so very much about flyover country and how the majority of Americans were in touch with the national values that remain to this day, the pervasive ideology of America, despite what the mainstream media would have you believe. But there was much talk of left-wing coastal elites. And this notion of coastal elitism, in my view, is no more apparent than on the West Coast, where Hollywood itself has sort of become interjected into national political discourse by showing up to protest and doing what we'll talk about in a minute with Alyssa Milano and the heartbeat bill in Georgia, and finding themselves on Capitol steps and making scenes in public. And for my part, I used to be a big fan of watching awards shows. We are relative cinephiles in my house. We love our movies. And I have gotten to the point now where I'm sure you and many of your readers have gotten, which is to say, we cannot tolerate anymore simply watching Hollywood in the aggregate at an award show because it has gotten to be so distastefully political.
There are people that are switching off those shows, which is clear by their ratings that have been in decline now for the last almost an entire decade. And, for example, the Oscars, when they reached a historic low the first time Jimmy Kimmel hosted, it went down an additional 25% the second time Jimmy Kimmel hosted. And part of that is this condescending preaching of Hollywood values to the country that the country doesn't want, coupled with a kind of malignant narcissism that we see from celebrities, people who go from waiting on tables to waiting for their limo drivers seemingly overnight, feel guilty about their wealth, about their success, want to achieve a level of significance and importance. And, you know, there are certain causes that are trendy in Hollywood and others that are not. If you held a rally for the Second Amendment, probably no one would show up. If you held a rally for the right to life, that you'd people would come, but there'd be Antifa coming to beat you up. You can see it. This unplanned movie that was just released went through every possible obstacle. Hollywood, just recently, Samantha Bee said, urged people not to go see this poison propaganda film. And, you know, it just happens to be, it's a very low budget film. It's actually doing very well because it's a true emotional story of someone who had a change of heart when they found out the truth about abortion procedure. But Hollywood people have their blinders on, which leads segues perfectly into your subject that you started with.
So let's
the Georgia heartbeat bill.
Let's talk a little bit about what actually transpired just 2 days ago in Georgia. Actress Alyssa Milano, who, as far as I'm concerned, I would not consider to be the top end of Hollywood elite, probably one of the B-level TV stars at this point in her career, but around 30 other Georgia-based TV and film workers. And Georgia is a very common, very popular film site because there are particular tax credits that the film industry receives. And for those of you who like to watch serial television or who find themselves watching cable movies that are put together or serials, you will see often Made in Georgia as a stamp that that's actually where production took place. So 30 other of these TV and film workers came to the Capitol to urge Republican Governor Brian Kemp to veto an abortion bill. Now, Alyssa Milano was asked a very striking question. I think it was very interesting because Representative Dominic Lauricia actually confronted her and said, "Are you a Georgia citizen?" And her answer was, of course, no. But she said, "I have 30 other citizens out in the hallway, and they have something to say." So do you think an effort like Alyssa Milano's is going to be, in the end, a productive one against this bill?
I actually do not. I think it's very similar to the way we see Hollywood trying to influence an election. Many Hollywood celebrities were on the ground in Texas campaigning for the then-senatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke, which he lost. And, of course, Hollywood went crazy campaigning against candidate Trump, who won. It seems like when Hollywood jumps into an issue, there's a two-edged sword. I mean, certainly they have celebrity power. Alyssa Milano is able to get, especially the entertainment press, which is a very soft press, will is like a megaphone for her to get her message out. And that's an advantage, the celebrity power, celebrity endorsement. But on the other side, rank-and-file voters see Hollywood get involved, and they see it as a negative. And politicians know this. And so in this case, I think it really looks like interlopers, people from outside of the state coming in there. And this letter, even to me, they've overplayed their hands, so to speak. It breaks my – you know, you talked about Alyssa Milano not being – one of the Hollywood elite, and that's true. I have a feeling that her agent is starving right now. But some of the people on this letter, you know, are A-listers. In many cases, I would say, unfortunately, they are. You know, Alec Baldwin, who, well, now he has a career basically doing a bad imitation of the president.
Yes.
You know, there's some elder statesmen like Sean Penn, Mia Farrow, known to be associated with the left. But one that breaks my heart is Ben Stiller. And I Christina Applegate, who is, yeah, she works. But to see Ben Stiller on there, really, that's so sad. Because what they're doing is so misguided, so uninformed. Again, it's similar to their hostility to the movie Unplanned. They don't take the trouble to educate themselves on the science of human development. The left in general points fingers at the right, claiming the right is anti-science. But their attitude toward the science of human development, the actual reality of the medical procedure of abortion, depending upon what stage the abortion takes place in, those things, they're woefully ignorant. It's in many cases, you know, intentionally like an ostrich hiding from the facts. And there's no consistency. Somebody like Alyssa Milano, she's one of the founding mothers, I use that term, you know, rhetorically, of the Me Too movement.
Yes.
And yet she's out there now defending Joe Biden in a very overt, explicit way. you know, and this, I mean, I know it's a little bit off topic, but it shows the shameless audacity that these people will engage in terms of hypocrisy. They'll take a stand on an issue like Leo DiCaprio, who will virtue signal on people's carbon footprint when he goes and parties on oil chic yachts after flying in on his private jet. And so they're, you know, Sean Penn, who will lecture about the importance of free expression and go support and endorse the absolute unfree Venezuela. He did with Hugo Chavez. He did with Maduro. So these people are, you know, there's no consistency. There's no credibility, really. So in the end, I do not think Governor Kemp is going to be swayed. And I think that the bill, by the way, has these carve-outs. They had to draft it that way to keep from the media from tearing them to pieces. So they have the usual carve-outs for rape and incest and, you know, a woman in danger of losing her life and all this kind of stuff. But the citizens of Georgia, I believe, and their representatives resent these Hollywood elites coming in there. And I think it's just going to backfire.
It's so interesting because you anticipated what I was going to ask next. I'm really fascinated by the human psychology at work here, and I want to inject myself into the mind of someone like Alyssa Milano and think, do the American people truly look at someone like Alyssa Milano and think her form, her individual brand of high-handed elitism, that's effective? In other words, is the American populace sitting at home or streaming on Twitter and seeing the footage of this confrontation in the Capitol and with Representative Larichia, and are they thinking, wow, I need to really rethink my perspective on this? Does she believe truly that what she's doing is effective? And for that matter, truly, does the rest of the Hollywood elite believe what they do to this end speaks as part of the national currency, number one, and number two, will actually get the job done?
Well, you know, it's interesting because everything in Hollywood is based on sort of two things that goals, if you will, that they're trying to acquire in their career. And what one is pure respect, and the other is fame. And the arc of fame is very fleeting. Alyssa Milano is a very good example of that. Being an actress, she's had a couple of good successes with television, but her arc of fame is headed downward. And she also is someone, when you're someone that achieves your success based on pretending to be other people, sometimes you feel a sort of a guilt about having lots of wealth, especially when you didn't write the scripts. And you're basically paid, you know, oh, look at that. She can pretend to be other people. Isn't she great? So they want something that's a more serious kind of significance. And activism is a place to be to get that more serious gravitas. So I'm, in some ways, in talking to these people, I don't think they care whether they're effective. I think they care whether they are elevated.
And James has been my guest. James, I'm sorry we got to let you go. I could talk to you so much longer, but jamesherson.com is his website. Law professor, author, cultural commentator. I encourage you to check out his book. You have been listening to Washington Watch. Follow Tony Perkins on Twitter at T Perkins and visit more information on this program at tonyperkins.com. We'll see you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-866-866.
1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.